Hey, good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here on Nova M Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Yeah, did you watch any of the last press conference? Kind of like the last picture show, right? Just as bleak and as filled with dark humor. I watched some of it today until finally I just couldn't take it anymore and got up and walked out and went for a four-mile walk. Just anything. And the temperature here today when I took that walk was like 22 degrees with a wind chill. Anything to get away from this bastard. It was unbelievable stuff. Unbelievable. And did you notice that Helen Thomas, who was sitting in the front row right in front of Chuckle Nuts, held up her hand several times? And not once did Bush call on her. How old is Helen Thomas now? 86 years old, who has more credibility about Bush's presidency, her criticism of Bush's presidency than Bush has with having been there for 8 years. But what a nasty ass way to treat the senior member of the White House press corps. Just ignore her. Jesus God. Anyway, we're going to have an awful lot of sound from that. I say awful advisedly because it is awful. Moron sounds out the wazoo from the unelected idiot's exit briefing today. So, fasten your seatbelt and prepare for this because you have to hear this. It's astonishing. This is one truly mentally ill man. The denial, the obfuscation, the complete lies, the toxic narcissism, all of this you will hear in the comments that we have for you tonight from his press briefing today. When he said he inherited a recession, I mean, Jesus God, it's astonishing what he and his puppeteer, Dick Cheney, are trying to foist off on the American public. And truth be told, probably a good 40% of the American public, 30, 40% of the American public is going to believe it. Those are the ones who are completely saturated with the lies and deceptions by right-wing talk radio in this country, which blasts and broadcasts 24/7, coast to coast, border to border. You know the truth. I know the truth. Hopefully enough of us know the truth that we can make sure that the Republicans do become the permanent minority forever and ever, world without end. Amen. Anything that has the stench of a Republican on it should be tossed out of the political system. I'm serious. They should be banned as a political party, ripped to pieces. Send John Boehner out to find a job in Ohio someplace working at a steel mill or a tire factory or a manufacturing plant of some sort. Destroy the Republican Party. Just destroy it by whatever means necessary. I don't care. Destroy it because it and its leadership has made a serious attempt at destroying this country. More on that a little bit later, too. Mark Perkel sends an email from California, says people are asking if Bush accomplished anything good during his presidency. The answer is yes. One good thing he did was that he utterly destroyed the Republican Party. All the myths that Republicans are fiscal conservatives are now gone. The idea that Republicans are better for the economy, gone. Trickle-down economics and tax cuts for the rich, completely discredited. Privatizing Social Security, never mind. Mark says, America is paid to learn the hard way, but at least we finally can say that Republican ideas are an utter failure, and hopefully we will never go back there again. I'd like to agree with I do agree with Mark Perkel. Hopefully we'll never go back there again. But you and I both know that the American public has an attention span of 10 minutes and a memory of about 8 minutes in real time. And based on that, based on the fact that the majority, not you, Truth Seeker, not me, but the majority of Americans have an attention span and a memory that you can measure in minutes. Chances are we will, in this country, continue to elect these filthy Republicans who should, as I said, the party itself should be declared an enemy of the people and destroyed. Just destroy it. go into Republican Party headquarters, seize their records, their computers, blow them up, set them on fire, the records and computers. Take the people who are members of the Republican Party, tell them they have 90 days to get out or they're going to be arrested for high treason. Huh? That a little bit too drastic? Not drastic enough, trust me. All right, let's start this, all right? So Raisin Brain holds his very last presser today. And you knew that the unintended irony would flow like a mighty river, right? Now, this first one is from his opening remarks where he talks about his relationship with the press over the last 8 years. He uses one of his favorite Bushisms, but says it with such a straight face, you got to wonder if he actually thinks it really is a word. So I hope your dinner has settled. Those of you on the West Coast, I don't know what to tell you, but let us begin.
We have been through a lot together. As I look to the room, I see Jake, Mike, Herman, and Compton. It just seemed like yesterday that I was on the campaign trail and you were analyzing my speeches and my policies. And I see a lot of faces that travel with me around the world in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Africa. I see some new faces, which goes to show there's some turnover in this business. Through it all, it's been, I have respected you.
Oh, please.
Sometimes I didn't like the stories that you wrote or reported on. Sometimes you misunderestimated me. But always the relationship I have felt has been professional. And I appreciate it.
Yeah?
I appreciate, I do appreciate working with you. My friends say, what is it like to deal with the press corps? I said, these are just people that are trying to do the best they possibly can.
The best they possibly can. And given the fact that the Bush crime family withheld information and deliberately lied to the press corps for 8 years, everything he said, it's just from bizarro world. It's from through the looking glass. Who does this crazy man think he's talking to? The only news that was given to the crack White House press corps has been those little dollops and drabs that the press flacks from Scott McClellan to Tony Snow to Too Much Cappuccino Perino to the whole list of them. Every bit of information given out to the press was either a flat-out lie or a deception or some sort of weird pretzel-like twist on what really happened or completely ignoring the statement. I keep thinking about this poor, pasty-faced Scott McClellan and Ari Fleischer before him. Fleischer was a master liar, a master at it. And had the moral underpinnings to go with being a master liar. He didn't have any. And poor old Scott McClellan, who took over then, who did have some moral underpinnings, and watched as he saw his very soul being spun into hell because of what he was doing. So, you know, when Bush stands there and talks about he appreciates working with the press corps, I thought I was going to vomit all over my TV monitor. And it was at that point, 2 minutes into the presser, that I got up and said, enough of this. I'll listen to it tonight when we do the program. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
When Heston needed Texas, did you handguns concealed? I proudly sat right down and signed my name. I'm George W. from Texas. We lead the states in dirty air.
We ride from Texas with polluted air.
I'm George W. from Texas. We lead the states in dirty air.
Grandfather's wallet and number one.
We could save the last sea turtles, but
they don't vote, so I don't care. Compassionate conservative, don't know what it means. It's something we cooked up for press release. Texas leads the world in the death penalty. But
my job is a decision-making job, and as a result, I make a lot of decisions, and it's important for me to have an opportunity to speak to you and others who would be listening, explain why I have made some of the decisions I have made, the basis on which I have made decisions, to explain the philosophy behind some of the decisions I have made.
Did that register with you? Back to the last press briefing, which may be proof that there is some sort of divine being somewhere who is watching over us, or it may be that that divine being has exercised its options to continue to keep us here in hell. I'm not sure. But anyway, the first reporter up asked about the Gaza situation. The reporter said, "Do you believe that the Gaza conflict will have ended by the time you leave office?" Let me digress. Isn't that a wonderful question from a half-witted reporter? Isn't that wonderful?
Do you think it'll end by the time?
Do you believe that the Gaza conflict will have ended by the time you leave office? Do you approve of the way that Israel has conducted it? And why were you unable to achieve the peace deal that you had sought?
Remind me of the 3 points, will you? Because I'm getting a little older.
Will it end by the time you leave office? Do you approve of the
I hope
conflict?
So. I'm for a sustainable ceasefire. And a definition of a sustainable ceasefire is that Hamas stops firing rockets into Israel. And there will not be a sustainable ceasefire if they continue firing rockets. I happen to believe the choice is Hamas's to make. And we believe that the best way to ensure that there is a sustainable ceasefire is to work with Egypt to stop the smuggling of arms into the Gaza that enables Hamas to continue to fire rockets. And so countries that supply weapons to Hamas have got to stop. Hamas, obviously, if they're interested in a sustainable ceasefire, needs to stop, you know, arming. And then, of course, you know, countries contingent to the Gaza need to work to stop the smuggling. And it's a difficult task. I mean, there's tunnels and...
There's tunnels and you know. So let's get this straight. To have a sustainable ceasefire, Hamas needs to stop firing into Israel. Hamas needs to stop firing rockets into Israel. And countries near Gaza need to stop giving Hamas rockets to ensure a ceasefire of Hamas firing rockets into Israel. So he repeats these same three sentences over and over and over. It's all about Hamas firing into Israel. I guess that's how all these hundreds and hundreds of Palestinians keep getting killed. Stray rockets, maybe, the Hamas is launching into Israel. Well, let's listen for a second here to Mark Regev. On the BBC. You don't hear this sort of thing on American media. This is Mark Regev, a spokesman for the Israeli Prime Minister, admitting a couple of days ago on the BBC that Israel broke the ceasefire truce, not Hamas. That Israel broke the truce, not Hamas. Now, the reason this is important to hear is because in this country, we are told endlessly that Hamas broke the truce. Let's listen to a spokesperson for the Israeli Prime Minister.
There was a time when Israelis were safe from Hamas rockets during the recent ceasefire. In May, there were 149 rocket attacks. In June, before the ceasefire started on the 18th, there were 84. In the rest of June, just 3. Throughout July, August, September and October, there were only 15 attacks, and Israel agrees that none of these rockets were fired by Hamas. On November the 4th, Israel launched an attack that killed six Hamas fighters just inside the Gaza Strip. They say the militants were building a tunnel to try and kidnap an Israeli soldier. The result was a fresh barrage of rockets from Hamas. After November the 4th, there were 68 and 52 in December. During the entire period of the ceasefire, no Israelis were killed by Hamas rockets.
Our goals are minimalistic and defensive. Success is freeing the civilian population of southern Israel from the fear of an incoming Hamas rocket.
But if that was the case, there were no Hamas rockets during the ceasefire. Before November the 4th, there were no Hamas rockets for 4 months.
And that's correct.
And that's correct. Mark Regev speaking for the Israeli government. And that's correct. On November 4th, Israel violated the ceasefire that existed between Hamas and Israel. And Israel did so, attacked and killed six people in Gaza because the Israeli military said the Hamas was involved, or somebody was involved, in building tunnels. You also heard that during the ceasefire that they had agreed to, there were no rockets being fired. And you heard that not from an anti-Semite or a self-hating Jew or some right left-wing idiot in this country or some left-wing peace creep idiot in Israel. You heard it from Mark Regev, a spokesman for the Israeli Prime Minister. Now, my question is, why is a statement like that not broadcast on American media?
Humanitarian needs. We understand the fright that can come when you're worried about a rocket landing on top of your home.
Well, there are innumerable Palestinians or Gazans that you could check in with there, Bush, and find out how that feels about having a rocket come in on top of your house and then watching 15, 20 members of your extended family burned to death. Back to the press briefing, another one of the reporters that Bush claims to respect. Now, remember that bit, when was it earlier on the presidency when Bush and Cheney were standing somewhere and Bush didn't know the microphone was on? And he was referencing a New York Times reporter, I forget which one, it will come to me in a second, but the name is unimportant. And he said to Cheney, look at that guy over there. He's a class, I'm paraphrasing, but he's a number one ass blank. Fill in the rest, because for some weird reason I'm not supposed to say that on this radio station. Not this radio station, I mean radio network. And Cheney said, yeah, big time. Remember that? That's the press corps that he respects. Next reporter in the barrel stands up or sits down and says, in the past, when you've been asked to address bad poll numbers or your own popularity, you've said that history will judge that you did the right thing, that you thought you did the right thing. But without getting into your motives or your goals, I think a lot of people have been disappointed at the execution of some of your ideals, whether Iraq or Katrina or the economy. What would your closing message be to the American people about the execution of these goals?
When the history of Iraq is written, historians will analyze, for example, the decision on the surge. The situation was looked like it was going fine, and then violence for a period of time
began to throw the progress of Iraq into doubt. And rather than accepting the status quo and saying, oh, it's not worth it, or the politics makes it difficult, or, you know, the party may end up being, you know, not doing well in the elections because of the violence in Iraq, I decided to do something about it and sent 30,000 troops in as opposed to withdrawing. And so that part of history is certain, and the situation did change. Now, the question is, in the long run, will this democracy survive? And that's going to be the challenge for future presidents.
That's going to be the challenge. Well, it'll be a challenge because you made Iraq a killing field, you moron. It didn't have to be a challenge for anybody. And now, as you have done with every single thing in your life, you failed man. You're going to walk away from this and leave it for the next guy to deal with. Remember back when you were running for the presidency, you scum sucker, and you said you're not into nation building because Bill Clinton unleashed NATO in Central Europe. Remember that? You're not into nation building. Was that a joke? And in this little bit, he says the situation prior to the surge looked like it was going to be fine. And he says, and then violence for a period of time began to throw the progress of Iraq into doubt. A period of time? You mean 4 years, right? Is that the period of time? Right? 4 years. 4 years of maimed and dead innocent Iraqis and Americans for an illegal war. This, you know, I want to call him a son of a bitch. I want to unleash a string of profanity, but what's the point? I've known for a long time, as most people do, that when you're dealing with someone who is mentally ill, who is truly mentally ill, you can't expect the same perception of reality as, say, you have, because you're not mentally ill. You may have some emotional problems, you may have your little neuroses, but you're not psychotic. George Bush is a sociopath. He is mentally ill, in addition to having no moral center whatsoever. So it is almost comedy to sit here tonight. And I realize a lot of people who are listening to these said, oh, Malloy's going to do this for the first hour. Goodbye. See you later. That's cool. That's fine. But I want to have on this program, you know, we record all these programs, I want to have an historical record of what this son of a bitch said. Something that maybe 35 years from now, when I'm long dead and gone, my daughter, my children, my grandchildren can just pick up Dad's audio file of what this psychopath said all those years ago. So if you need to not listen, I understand. I know a lot of people in this country have had enough of this bastard, and I understand that.
Yes, we have. We'll have an 8-year-long audio file complete with transcripts.
Oh, I know. You've got.
We have a historical record the Smithsonian would envy.
I that's the truth. I saw some of it today. It's just boxes of actualities of this crazy bastard. Now, next book, Bush took on the second part of the question about how historians will consider his handling of economic issues.
Look, I inherited a recession. I'm ending on a recession. In the meantime, there were 52 months of uninterrupted job growth. And I defended tax cuts when I campaigned. I helped implement tax cuts when I was president. And I will defend them after my presidency as the right course of action. Now, obviously, these are very difficult economic times. It's when people analyze the situation, there will be this problem started before my presidency. It obviously took place during my presidency.
Well, hello?
The question facing a president is not when the problem started, but what did you do about it when you recognized the problem?
Oh.
And I readily concede.
Oh, okay.
I chunked aside some of my free market principles when I was told by chief economic advisors that the situation we were facing could be worse than the Great Depression. So I've told some of my friends who said, you know, you've taken an ideological position on this issue. Well, why'd you do what you did? I said, well, if you were sitting there and heard that the Depression could be greater than the Great Depression, I hope you would act too, which I did.
Does that make any sense to you? Listen to this man. I realize you've had enough of him. So have I. He said he helped implement tax cuts when he was president. He'll defend them after his presidency as the right course. And the tax cuts for the wealthy 1, 2, 3% of the population in this country is part of what bankrupted us. And this ignorant savage is going to say, until he croaks, oh, yeah, tax cut. Yeah, I did the right thing. And then he says, now, obviously, these are very difficult times because of him. Because of, among other things, his utter mishandling of the economy, his decision to launch two wars. He tries to slough it off on anybody. Well, I inherited a recession. No, you didn't, you son of a bitch. You inherited budget surpluses as far into the future as I could see, the eye could see. Was there a tech bubble? Yes. Could that have been handled by someone who understood economics? Yes. Was there anyone in your administration who did? No. He said he was told by his chief economic advisors that the situation we were facing could be worse than the Great Depression. No, Bush, the situation you caused. There's no responsibility here. None. None whatsoever. So then he says he told some of his friends who, you know, have taken an ideological position on some of his friends who have taken an ideological position. Who would that be, George? But he said to his friends when they said, why did you do what you did? And I said, well, if you were sitting there and heard that the depression would be greater than the depression, does that make any sense? I hope you would act too, which I did. What did you do, George? What did you do? Now, again, I will issue a plea. I made it a challenge. I'll make it a plea. Is there any Republican listening and who has the courage and the ability to put together coherent sentences to call this program and tell me, what did your boy do that benefited the American public? And when he says, well, when your economic advisors tell you depression is going to be greater than the greater depression, a depression, I hope you would act too, which I did. Republican, tell me what he did. What did he do that stemmed the tide of the catastrophe that he's brought on this country, that we are going to be paying for? And so will you if you're a working class Republican. If you're not in the top 2%, your ass is going to be mowed down by the same lawnmower that's coming for all of us. Do you understand that, Mr. Republican, Ms. Republican? Do you understand that? No, of course you don't. But take a look at your retirement portfolio and tell me, was that the result of Bill Clinton? We'll be right back.
And if you're going to ride off into the sunset, make sure you're using an effective sunblock.
Oh, no, it's true. I'm a sensitive cowboy and I don't know what to do. Oh, no, it's kind of strange. I'm the last sensitive cowboy. Oh, no, no, it's true. I'm a sensitive cowboy and I don't know what to do. Oh, no, it's kind of strange. I'm the last sensitive cowboy on the range.
Tax cuts matter. He said, when somebody builds a new building, somebody's got to come and build the building. And when the building expanded, it prevented additional opportunities for people to work, new opportunity employments.
Yeah. listening, apparently, to what we're doing to you with these Bush sound clips today is Ron, who is still lost in Pennsylvania. And Ron writes in, Mike, he's talking to no one in this presser, which is the point. Bush's dullness and babbling drunkologue serve to dishearten anyone left listening. And his lackluster approach has the effect of saying, this is a meaningless function, and I don't give a crap what you think, because it's all for my amusement anyway. His petulance and dispassionate speech really function to make a mockery of all who still cling to the so-called reality-based community. And for all his glibness and fake Texas swagger, they're little more than taunt to those who would like to see him behind bars. You ain't going to do nothing to me, so shut up! The next reporter, and forget why they hate us, this reporter says, why do we hate you? Yeah, that's what he's trying to say. It was very interesting. Reporter says, I'd like to ask you about your critics. A couple of years ago, Charles Krauthammer, columnist and Harvard-trained psychiatrist, coined a term, Bush derangement syndrome, to talk about your critics who disagreed with you most passionately, not just your policies, but seemed to take an animosity toward you. I'm just wondering, as you look back, why you think you engendered such passionate criticism, animosity, and do you have any message specifically to those to that particular part of the spectrum of your critics?
Most people I see, you know, when I'm moving around the country, for example, they're not angry. And they're not hostile people. And so I view those who get angry and yell and say bad things and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's just a very few people in the country. I don't know why they get angry. I don't know why they get hostile. It's not the first time, however, in history that people have expressed themselves in sometimes undignified ways. I've been reading, you know, a lot about Abraham Lincoln during my presidency, and there's some pretty harsh discord when it came to the 16th president, just like there's been harsh discord for the 43rd president. Presidents can try to avoid hard decisions and therefore avoid controversy. That's just not my nature. I'm the kind of person that is willing to take on hard tasks, and in times of war, people get emotional. I understand that. I've never really, spent that much time, frankly, worrying about the loud voices. I, of course, hear them, but they didn't affect my policy, nor did they affect how I made decisions.
Well, no kidding. We could all collectively shout from our rooftops, and you wouldn't change a thing. You don't give a goddamn about what the American people wanted. The only thing you were concerned about, you wasted, insignificant, historically speaking, little man, was your bloody illegal constitution-wrecking agenda. You really did it to us, George. He says, when I'm moving around the country, I see people, they're not angry, and they're not hostile. What is he talking about? What he sees from his limo window? And later on, in that little clip, he says, there's some pretty harsh discord when it came to the 16th president, referring to Lincoln, just like there's been harsh discord for the 43rd president, referring to himself again in the third person. You're just exactly like Lincoln, George. Everybody says so, too, you know? You and Lincoln. Boy, Lincoln really had some problems, just like you, George. Jesus Christ. I mean, the comparisons are eerie, aren't they, George? You and Abe Lincoln. And he says, presidents can try to avoid hard decisions. That's not my nature. I'm the kind of person that, is willing to take on hard tasks. Yeah, George, illegal wars are hard work. Ignoring drowning victims in New Orleans is a tough job. Trashing the Constitution is extremely difficult. Getting your so-called legal staff to write the appropriate memos to save you and your vice president's ass from any kind of legal prosecution, that's difficult stuff, isn't it, George? Huh? Rigging the game so that your friends in the banking and financial industry and on Wall Street can just continue to rape and pillage and plunder. Yeah, that's hard stuff. Right, George? Nah, none of this is his responsibility. It's all difficult stuff. It's hard being president of the United States, especially. See, the subtext to all of this is it's very difficult, especially when you're not appreciated. But you know what? Doesn't bother me. Nah, I don't care. Couldn't care less. I'll just go about being the kind of a hard-charging man I am. Yes, indeed. I had to protect the country. You know, after that 9/11 attack, I had to protect the country. Hadn't been any since. That's because we used torture and stuff. You know, I had to protect the country. And that's what I did. Nobody understands how hard it is being president. It's really, I'm getting lost for words again. It's really unbelievable. George Bush, with his mental illness, has taken all of us into mental illness. I mean, some of us, keep those hounds at bay just barely anyway. But Bush has absolutely removed the line between reality and delusion. He's just absolutely trashed it. And there's so many people in this country who look at that and say, well, the President of the United States couldn't be crazy, so neither am I. That's the damage. Welcome back. It is about 7 past the hour. We are about halfway. We only have 2 more of these sound clips from Bush's so-called final press conference today. An exercise in denial, a delusion, arrogance, toxic narcissism. I don't know how to label it, so I won't even try. But if you were here during the first hour of the program, then you understand what I'm saying. And better yet, if you watched this event this morning, then you really know what I'm making reference to. And again, our phone lines are always open to any Republican who wants to call in to explain to us what George Bush has done, positive for this country. The question came up, I'm sure, in a lot of people's minds when Bush was getting all reminiscent, even though he was still delusional. Is there any room that this rat bastard was going to admit that he made any mistakes? Any room in that Q&A session with the crack White House press corps where might be crowded in just a tiny bit of truth? A reporter says, 4 years ago, you were asked if you had made any mistakes. And I'm not trying to play gotcha, Mr. President, but I wonder, when you look back over the long arc of your presidency, do you think, in retrospect, that you've made any mistakes? And if so, what was the single biggest mistake that you may have made? Now, that was the question. Keep in mind, Bush here gives the usual mealy-mouthed claptrap about not having that mission accomplished banner on the aircraft carrier. And wishing he'd landed the plane in New Orleans during Katrina. But then he had this to say.
There is no such thing as short-term history. I don't think you can possibly get the full breadth of an administration until time has passed.
One thing about the presidency is that you can only make decisions, you know, on the information at hand. You don't get to have information after you've made the decision. It's not the way it works. And you stand by your decisions, and you do your best to explain why you made the decisions you made. There have been disappointments. Abu Ghraib obviously was a huge disappointment during the presidency. Not having weapons of mass destruction was a significant disappointment.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to call those mistakes or not, but things didn't go according to plan. Let's put it that way.
Things that didn't go according to plan. They were things that didn't go according to Cheney's evil plan. He says, I don't think you can possibly get the full breadth of an administration until time has passed. Yeah, until time has passed and statute of limitations has run out, or all the primary suspects are dead. Right, George? And this bit about, he says, one thing about the presidency is that you can only make decisions, you know, on the information at hand. Not necessarily true. There's context, there's history, even short-term history, you dumb ass. There's previous behavior by the players in whatever escapade is unfolding before your very eyes. He goes on to say you don't get to have information after you've made the decision. Yes, you do. That's called the scientific method, George. You know, 2 + 2 only equals 4 until it's discovered that 2 + 3 equals 4. And I don't mean from a O'Brien, Winston Smith point of view, but I mean if the scientific method proves that the original conclusion was wrong, then you change the conclusion. And what's that based on? It's based on information you get after you've made a decision. But that's way beyond you, you dumbass. So he was upset to learn that upon taking office, he wasn't given a staff of, I don't know, little tiny fit-in-your-drawer psychics to predict the future. Is that what you're saying? Was that what Karl Rove promised you when you were back in Texas playing with yourself? Is that what you were promised? Don't worry, George. We'll have a little circle of psychics who will tell you everything you need to know. Don't worry. He says there have been disappointments. Abu Ghraib was a huge disappointment. What does that mean? The authorization of torture by him and his top echelon of war criminals that he is trying to put in such a passive frame of speech. Oh, well, you know, that was a huge disappointment during the presidency, he says. No, the part that was a huge disappointment, you psychopath, was the part about the photos getting out. You were fine. All of you war criminals were fine with it until people started passing around photos. And another big disappointment, not having weapons of mass destruction. I guess he's referring to Iraq. Not having weapons of mass destruction was a significant disappointment. Well, once you realized there were no weapons of mass destruction and you had overthrown and seen to the execution of Saddam Hussein, why didn't you take the new information and get out of someone else's country, George? Nah, we wanted Iraq to have deadly weapons, and we're sorry they didn't. Shoot, Rumi wanted to get all those ones back from Saddam that he'd given him, and they didn't have them, the bastards. Now, most leaders would be happy that there weren't deadly weapons there, but me, I was disappointed. I was disappointed. Because I was hoping that magically they would appear. Because, you see, I and everybody at the top of my administration knew we were telling you dumb-ass members of the press corps stupid-ass lies that you would then turn around and feed to the terminally brain-dead American public. But I was disappointed because I was hoping. You know, it's like when I was a little kid, and I used to hope for a pony, and I'd hope and hope and hope, and by Christ, a pony would show up. And I thought it would work that way with weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Goddamn Dick Cheney, he told me it would, and it didn't. So yeah, that was a significant disappointment. And I'll never forgive him or Karl Rove. Or Mihijo, you know, my little Mexican attorney general. Hijo, Tiano, amigo, I don't know. And that other guy brought in, you, John Yu. Somebody said, here's Mr. You. And I said, no, me, I'm me. No, it's you. No, him, me. Ha ha. And we had a lot of, hell, I still have fun with that joke. And then that Vietnamese guy we brought in, Min or Vin or somebody, who said, yeah, it's okay to torture. It's their fault. And I didn't find any weapons. And I'll be forever pissed. I'm going to tell my mom. Huh. No weapons of mass destruction. They're there. I know they're there. You know what he did with them? He took them over to Iraq. Or no, we're in Iraq. He took them over to Syria. Oh no, we already bombed Syria. I don't know what's going on.
He says he's ready to lead us at much more than 10 cents a day. Who's really paying the tune while we watch Georgie prance? I think of Thomas Jefferson, and it makes me want to cry. To think that the chair he sat in someone could buy. George wears his faith like a money belt, but I'll pray to Mad Time instead. Please come back, Tom, and save us from King George again. And his friends.
It's in the Gulf Coast countries' interest that there be a stable Iran. Iran that is capable of rejecting Iranian influence.
Yeah. Sure, why not? That's what George Bush indulges in or involves himself in on an ongoing basis. How to live inside George Bush while he rejects George Bush influences. Only it just doesn't work, does it, George? It gets real crowded and noisy in there with all those voices, among them God. Huh? Now, Bush, at this point, actually, I've got a couple more. I said there were only two more. I actually have more than that. And again, if you want to bail out, I understand. Go. I know there's other things, but this guy has ruined this country. He has destroyed us domestically and internationally. If you think this program's just going to walk away from this, say, well, I'm glad he's gone. Hey, Brock, what's happening? You're wrong. You're wrong, okay? Now, Bush gets a little head up here at the question over restoring America's moral standing in the world.
Oh, what? What? I didn't do nothing.
Reporter says, one of the major objectives that the incoming administration has talked frequently about is restoring America's moral standing in the world. And many of the allies of the new president, I believe that the president-elect himself has talked about the damage that Gitmo and that harsh interrogation tactics and torture and the war in Iraq without a UN mandate damaged America's moral standing in the world. I'm wondering, basically, Mr. President, what is your reaction to that?
I strongly disagree with the assessment that our moral standing has been damaged. It may be damaged amongst some of the elite, but people still understand America stands for freedom, that America is...
What?
Is a
what?
Country that provides such great hope. I disagree with this assessment that, you know, people view America in a dim light. I just don't agree with that. I tell people, yeah, you can try to be popular. And in terms of the decisions that I have made to protect the homeland, I wouldn't worry about popularity. What I would worry about is the Constitution of the United States.
Me too!
And putting plans in place that makes it easier to find out what the enemy is thinking.
Oh, okay.
Because all these debates will matter not if there's another attack on the homeland. The question won't be, you know, were you critical of this plan or not? The question is, why didn't you do something? Do you remember what it was like right after September the 11th around here?
How was it?
In press conferences and opinion pieces and in stories that sometimes were news stories and sometimes opinion pieces. People were saying, how come they didn't see it? How come they didn't connect the dots?
Yeah.
You remember what the environment was like in Washington? I do.
Yeah.
When people were hauled up in front of Congress.
Uh-huh.
And members of Congress were asking questions about how come you didn't know this, that, or the other. And then we start putting, you know, policy in place, legal policy in place
oh
to connect
God.
The dots. And all of a sudden people were saying, how come you're connecting the dots?
What?
And, so, Mike, I've heard all that.
Yeah.
I've heard all that. My view is that most people around the world, they respect America.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them doesn't like me. I understand that. Some of the writers and the, you know, opiners and all that. That's fine. That's part of the deal. But I'm more concerned about the country.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I remember that real well. Don't you, Truth Seeker? Remember when all them people were hauled up in front of Congress and 90% of them didn't even bother to show up? You remember that? And all of a sudden people are saying, how come you're connecting the dots? I remember that. I remember those Democrats up there saying, hey, why are you connecting the dots? Do I remember what it was like right after September the 11th? Yeah, I do. I do remember. That's when it occurred to me that you and the filthy bastards around you were not just totally incompetent, but possibly worse, that you possibly had information that the events of September 11, 2001 were going to occur, and you did nothing. You failed, little man. So, yeah, I remember what it was like right after September the 11th around here being the entire country. I remember. You know, I also remember. I remember a lot of stuff, George. All right, we have. Now, when we come back, we literally only have two left from today, and then one more from his exit interview with Britt Hume of Fox News Sunday. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Stand tall and strong. Oh, yeah. So with the Fourth Amendment gone, I got on the first.
first. That's why I'm spitting cyanide each and every verse. I see the Carlisle Group and Harris bank accounts. I see them plead the fifth each and every session now. Cause America's been took, it's plain to see. The oldest trick in the book is making enemy. A phony evil so the government can do its dirt and take away your freedom, lock and load, beat and search. Oil, blood, money make these killers ride cold. Suspicious suicide, people dying never told. It's all a part of playing God, so you think we need them. While being ass-crossed, take away your rights to freedom. Bear witness to the sickness of these dictators. Hope you understand the time, brother, cause it's major.
What could you do if you do? Through all the things we know, would you stand up for truth?
The best way to defeat the totalitarian of hate is with an ideology of hope, an ideology of hate.
Okay. An ideology of hope, you know, an ideology of hate. Joanne emailed in and said, I'm so sick and tired of all the pundits taking up that argument that Bush should get such huge credit that we have not been attacked again since 9/11. And, of course, Bush says that, too. So see what a hero he is for keeping us safe. Well, Joanne writes, I think we're more at risk now for invading Iraq and escalating our enemies list big time. Has anyone ever given Clinton credit for his keeping us safe from the time the first attack on the World Trade Center happened shortly after Clinton took office up to the time he left office? No, not a word. And the big difference here is the fact that the culprits behind the first World Trade Center attack were rounded up quickly, tried and convicted, and are sitting in our prison for the rest of their lives. Where's Osama bin Laden, the culprit behind 9/11? He's still walking free to this day since the 2001 horrific attack on us on 9/11. 7 years ago, this is Joanne continuing to write, 7 years ago, President Bush said he wanted Osama bin Laden dead or alive. On September 13th, 2001, quote, the most important thing is for us to find Osama bin Laden. It is our number one priority, and we will not rest until we find him, end quote. 6 months later, March 13th, 2002, I don't know where bin Laden is. I have no idea and really don't care. It's not that important. It's not a priority, end quote. And, oh, Joanne writes, I forgot, my bad, Saddam Hussein was more of a threat to the U.S. than bin Laden. That's why we went after him. And Cheney said it doesn't matter that we haven't caught bin Laden. Can you imagine, Joanne writes, if Clinton had said that? And let's not forget that any time Clinton went after bin Laden, the Republicans accused him of wagging the dog. Remember that? And then after 9/11, those same Republicans blamed it all on Clinton for not getting bin Laden. Unbelievable. Joanne in Oceanside, California. Yeah, sure. Nobody ever talks about Clinton's pursuit, arrest, trial, conviction, and sentencing of the people who attacked the World Trade Center the first time. And but for the grace of Allah, the first attack on the Trade Center would have killed more than... How many people died in that attack? Three? Six? Had that succeeded, the death toll would have been, I have a feeling, in probably over 10, 15,000. So Clinton kept us safe after that for the next 7.5 years, didn't he? But you never hear that. You hear the apologists for this Nazi rat bastard George Bush all day, 24/7, border to border, coast to coast, on American talk radio. Huh? Don't you love it? Don't you love American talk radio? Huh? There it is. George Bush kept us safe. Bill Clinton, well, he gave George Bush a recession to deal with. He did. Yes, he did. And Bill Clinton, you know, he had all those times to send some missiles over there into Afghanistan and get bin Laden. Didn't do it. Didn't do it, did he? No, he didn't. I've decided that the reservoirs of contempt and hatred that I lug around behind me. I know. Don't send me emails and tell me I should let the burden go. These huge vats of discontent and rage and hatred that I pull behind me as I walk through this lonely life of being a radio talk show host, most of that is directed, probably 90% of it is directed at these filthy pig bastards who are on American talk radio, 24/7, coast to coast, border to border, because of what they do in terms of poisoning the political atmosphere. You know, all these polls that said George W. Bush had a 22% approval rating, and another 56 million people voted Republican in the last presidential election. Huh? Why was that? Is it because the pigs who run right-wing talk radio, which is 99% of all talk radio, convinced these brain-dead bastards that it's not Republican? No, it's not Republicans. It was just Bush. And Bush was never conservative. But John McCain is. No, John McCain is crazy. No, he's a conservative. And Sarah Palin, oh, she's a genius conservative. 56 million people voted the Republican presidential ticket. Astonishing. So, yeah, most of the hatred and venom and poison and contempt and disgust that is my burden to bear is directed at the scum who fill the airwaves 24/7, coast to coast, border to border, all over the place. There it is. Huh? Try to get away from it. Or you can wait until 9 o'clock Eastern time and plug into this radio program on all, what are we on now, Kathy? All 24, 25 stations? Woohoo! And thanks to all those stations for carrying this program. How many stations are the Pigman and the rest of these right-wing thugs on? Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And why is that?
Well, Mike, it's because in the free marketplace, people don't want to hear liberal talk. People want to hear rational, conservative talk that makes sense.
Another reporter asked this piglet about the responsibilities of the office of the president. His bizarre mocking and mugging for the camera about how hard it is to be president was just weird. Delusional. Especially the Bush bastard's comments at the end. The reporter says, Mr. President, you spoke of the moment that the responsibility of the office would hit Barack Obama. The world is a far different place than it was when it hit you. When do you think he's going to feel the full impact? And what, if anything, have you and the other presidents shared with him about the effects of the sometimes isolation, the so-called bubble of the office?
I believe this, the phrase burdens of the office is overstated. Yeah, it's kind of like, why me? Oh, the burdens, you know. Why did the financial collapse have to happen on my watch? It's just pathetic, isn't it? Self-pity. And I don't believe President-elect Obama will be full of self-pity. He will find, you know, the people that don't like you, they're critics, they're pretty predictable. Sometimes the biggest disappointments will come from your so-called friends.
I wonder who he's talking about there. Huh? Who are your so-called friends, George? You don't have any. This is the President of the United States. You know, it's kind of like, why me? Oh, the burdens, you know. Why did the financial collapse have to happen to my watch? It's pathetic, isn't it? Self-pity. How'd you like to be his kid? How'd you like to be a son of this sociopath? Self-pity. Jesus, God. He also got a little testy when reporter April Levine asked him more specifics about the Katrina response. She says, on New Orleans, you basically talked about a moment ago about the photo opportunity, but let's talk about what you could have done to change the situation for the city of New Orleans to be further along in reconstruction than where it is now.
This storm was a devastating storm, April, that required a lot of energy, a lot of focus, and a lot of resources to get New Orleans up and running. And has the reconstruction been perfect? No. Have things happened fairly quickly? Absolutely. And is there more to be done? You bet there is.
What more needs to be done?
Well, the more people need to get in their houses.
Jesus, God.
More people need to, you know, have their own home there.
Oh, yeah.
But the systems are in place to continue the reconstruction of New Orleans. You know, people said, but the federal response was slow. Don't tell me the federal response was slow when there was 30,000 people pulled off roofs right after the storm passed. You know, I remember going to see those helicopter drivers, Coast Guard drivers, to thank them for their courageous efforts to rescue people off roofs. 30,000 people were pulled off roofs right after the storm moved through. It's a pretty quick response. Could things have been done better? Absolutely. Absolutely. But when I hear people say the federal response was slow, then what are they going to say to those chopper drivers or the 30,000 that got pulled off the roofs?
I'm sorry? Was that what they should have said? Or you never should have been stranded in a situation where you were on a roof?
What's amazing to me about this is Bush acts like he personally orchestrated the federal response. And first off, half the first responders were in Iraq. And secondly, there was no coordinated communication efforts. Relief efforts were paltry. If anything, these people were left starving and drowning with no shelter, no food, no way to communicate with each other. It was horrifying, and he wants to take credit because, hey, people were pulled off the roofs.
Well, when you're a sociopath, when you have absolutely no link to reality, this is what you say. Mike in Seattle had a few thoughts about that pulled from the rooftop stuff. We'll share that with you when we come back. This is Nova M.
Have a sense of urgency. Now the mayor's been reduced to crying. I guess Bush said niggas been used to dying. He said, I know it looks bad, just have to wait. Forgetting folks are too broke to evacuate. Niggas starving and they dying of thirst. I bet he had to go and check on them refineries first. Making a killing off the price of gas. He would have been up in Connecticut twice as fast. After all that we've been through, nothing's changed. You can call Red Cross for the back remains that George Bush don't like black people. George Bush don't like black people. George Bush don't like black people. Come down.
Frankly, in the vote I got in the African-American community, I put people in my cabinet. I put people in my sub-cabinet.
You mean dark-skinned people? Oh. So when he talks about, he says, don't tell me the federal response was slow regarding New Orleans when there were 30,000 people pulled off roofs right after the storm passed. No, that's not what happened, you son of a bitch. In the first place, it was not 30,000, and it was not right after the storm passed. Mike in Seattle writes, I just threw up over the pull from the rooftop that was a comment by Bush. That was the Coast Guard and the Coast Guard Auxiliary. Bush had nothing to do with it. It was done without checking with the White House. The Coast Guard and the Coast Guard Auxiliary worked because the way our chain of command is set up and the missions we change, to do. The Coast Guard and the Auxiliary moved assets to safe locations, and as soon as the wind slowed down to flyable range, about 50 knots, if my memory is correct, the Coast Guard launched the rescue effort. The Auxiliary pitched in. Also, many of the Coast Guard and Auxiliary that were out saving people had their own houses destroyed by Katrina. So many of the Coast Guard and the Auxiliary had no home to go to, but they were out helping people. And he, and Mike goes on here. One of the reasons, he says here, and if you ask the Coast Guard or the Auxiliary people, they would probably say that they were just doing their job. The Coast Guard was the only part of the federal government that worked. As an auxiliary member, I trained with the Coast Guard and trained to their standards. No shrub should have credit for the pulled from the rooftops bit. He, like many other presidents, has expanded the Coast Guard mission while at the same time starving the Coast Guard for proper funding. Mike in Seattle, who identifies himself as a 15-year Coast Guard auxiliary member, an instructor, and licensed master with the Coast Guard, and on and on and on. But, yeah, if you remember, and this son of a bitch, George Bush, like he says, there's no such thing as short-term history. You hope there isn't, you chuckle-nut freak. But think back. Nothing happened for the people in New Orleans. Nothing. Nothing. Except gangs of out-of-control white people wandered around with rifles and shotguns committing murder against black people who were trying to flee. Who reported on that story other than the Nation, huh? And this useless sack of gristle, George W. Bush, says, oh, well, what about the 30,000 people? Blah, blah, blah. How many days went by? George Bush is a dry drunk and a coke user and a freak. But you and I remember, we saw the images on TV, didn't we? Day after day after day. Nothing. No response. Nothing. Except for the Coast Guard. Except for the heroic efforts. And they were the efforts of heroes to pull people out of certain death. And where was Bush? Where was FEMA? Where was Homeland Security? Where was anybody? Where was the Interior Department? Where was Emergency Medical Services? Where was any of it? And how many people are still waiting for some kind of response from the government? And what does this miserable son of a bitch say? When the reporter says, well, what more needs to be done? And he says, well, more people need to get in their houses. More people need to get in their houses? What does that mean? You crazed bastard. Their houses don't exist anymore. He says more people need to have their own homes there. Really? God, that's such an astute observation. More people need to get in their houses. More people need to have their own home there. Anybody who's listened to this program over a period of time knows that my language has degenerated right into the sewer because I despise this bastard so deeply, down to my DNA. You think it's tough to listen to the sound bites on this program of the psychopath? Let me tell you how tough it is to sit here during the day when Kathy's putting them together and to listen to this stuff or to read about it or to watch him on television. I feel like Bush.
I'm not going to whine and complain about it. I'm a tough talk show host. I can handle it.
This has been 8 years of unmitigated hell, night after night after night, realizing that my country's being destroyed, my economic system's being destroyed, my infrastructure's being destroyed. The faith in my institutions are being shredded. My constitution is being ended. The reputation of my country is being absolutely crapped on. The military is being has been reduced to battle-weary 6, 7, 8 deployment people who are desperate just to goddamn go home. And this man stands up there with his last press conference and says these things.
Well, what about 30,000 people pulled off the roofs, huh? What about that? What about that?
I don't know how this country has survived this administration. We haven't survived. Look at us. But I mean how this country has not erupted into open rebellion in the streets. Two things, I guess. Apathy and fear. Apathy because most of us are so goddamn tired of this, and fear because we know what Bush has concocted as law if anybody gets out of line. When we come back, one more. Manor Monkey from his exit interview with Britt Hume on Fox News Sunday. That's it. And then if you want to call in, we'll take some calls about this. All right? I'm going to stick on that topic. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy. This is Nova M. Seven past the hour. I do think it's important to have covered this this pig's last press conference. It's just horrifying what has happened in this country and Bush's utter inability because of his mental disease to take any responsibility here for anything. Kate writes from Mississippi Gulf Coast. She's still working with people who were victims of the Bush crime family's response to Katrina. She writes, regarding his Katrina response, I'm still shaking with rage. The folks we are working with are the ones who have fallen right into the cracks that have gotten deeper and more narrow. Some are living in their toxic trailers that will be hauled away at the end of February. The rest are living in single motel rooms, their food delivered to them daily. We have no low-income housing available for them. All are elderly or disabled. Some have children. Those responsible for sitting on the recovery money should go to a special place in hell. And it's the reality that people like Kate deal with on an ongoing basis, or people like you and me, as we read about the ongoing disaster, it's the rage that bubbles up when this son of a bitch stands there the way he did today, repeating over and over again when he's challenged about his incompetency. What about the 30,000? We got 30,000. What do you mean there wasn't a fast response? It's almost impossible for me to accept the fact that for the past 8 years, my country, my society, my foreign policy, my domestic policy, everything about me as a citizen of this country has been influenced, polluted, corrupted, destroyed, dumped on by this sociopathic bastard and his crew. Everything. Every single thing about my country. You know, we've talked often on this program about the rage and the anger. What about the impotent feeling? There's that too, isn't there? That feeling of, what? There's nothing I can do, right? Have you had that feeling? What am I supposed to do? You tune into this program to find out what you do, and you hear me say, oh, organize, organize, organize. Remember what Saul Alinsky said. Yeah, okay, okay, okay. Or, they're all bastards, vote Green Party. Okay, all right. We'll just make sure that McCain doesn't get elected. Okay, okay. And none of that deals with that feeling of impotency. Of knowing that when you get right down to it, There is nothing you can do. Nothing. You can become part of a greater effort. You can organize. You can invest your time over the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years and bring about some political change. If you have the will, if you have the time, if you have the resources, you can do that. And if you don't have the will or the time or the resources, you can take the little tiny slices and bits that you do have and combine them with other people who have little tiny slices and bits and do something. Can't you? Can't I? Can't we? Apparently not. And that's nothing, I don't think, to really be ashamed of. We possibly have passed that tipping point where we can bring about change. You know, I think about the change that was supposed to have occurred in the 60s and early 70s. And I look at the election in 1972, when everybody knew that George McGovern was a decent, honorable man who could have done so many things. And I look at Dick Nixon, who was a venal, psychopathic, crazed son of a bitch who won in a landslide. And another 35,000 Americans died because of it. And another million South Vietnamese. And Southeast Asians. And what did we learn from that? What do we learn? Apparently nothing. So, that feeling of impotence, powerlessness. Am I the only one, or do you feel that? I mean, come on. I know all you people listen to this program, men and women, you're all macho, and you're ready to kick ass and take names. Yeah. I know, me too, right? Huh? But come on, be honest. You know damn good and well, just like I know damn good and well, that kicking ass and taking names is not an option. You know that. So, what then? I don't know. I honest to God, have no idea. So here it is, the last one for tonight, hopefully the last one for quite some time here. The last moron sound of this evening from Bush's exit interview with the disgusting Brit Hume on Fox. Now, I hope federal prosecutors who usually monitor this program are listening. Bush here admits that he authorized torture. Okay? Brit Hume, the sorry son of a bitch, says, Mr. President, now the enhanced interrogation techniques, as some call them, torture as others call them, are being argued over to this hour. Some are saying you never get any good information by rough stuff, and others have said more than once that if we hadn't used these techniques, we would have had vital information and attacks could have been or would have been carried out on this country. Your view of that?
My view is that the techniques were necessary and are necessary to be used on a rare occasion to get information necessary to protect the American people. One such person who gave us information was Khalik Sheikh Mohammed. He was the mastermind of the September the 11th, 2001 attacks that killed nearly 3,000 people on our soil. And I'm in the Oval Office, and I am told that we have captured Khalik Sheikh Mohammed, and the professionals believe he has information necessary to secure the country. So I ask, what tools are available for us to find information from him? And they gave me a list of tools, and I said, are these tools deemed to be legal? And so we got legal opinions before any decision was made. And I think when people study the history of this particular episode, they'll find out we gained good information from Khalik Sheikh Mohammed in order to protect our country.
Well, there you go. And I said, are these tools deemed to be legal? And of course, the answer to that was no on about 9 different levels. And then he goes on, and so we got legal opinions. before any decision was made. We? Are we using the editorial we, the royal we? What are we using there? You know what he's using. He means I. So I had the dumb bastards who worked for me, the other neo-fascists, write me legal opinions. Mr. Gonzalez and Mr. Yu and Mr. Min and Mr. Cheney and all these people wrote me all the goddamn opinions I'd ever need. And therefore it became legal because, you know, when the president does it, it's not illegal. Last year, Bush said he was aware of the interrogation techniques, including torture. So now he admits to being a war criminal. What's going to be done about it?
And we're guarding the civil liberties by monitoring the program on a regular basis, by having the folks at NASA, the legal team, as well as the Inspector General, monitor the program, and we're briefing Congress.
Bang, 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 bang. The folks at NASA. I always like that one. Now, one more. Will you cue up that thing to the BBC again? I want you to hear this one more time tonight, because it's about all the attention that we're going to focus on this horrendous situation in the Middle East. You will hear not just members of the Israeli government, but also the chattering classes in this country that have totally sold out to AIPAC, and the political leadership of this country that has also totally sold out to AIPAC and the Likudniks. You will hear all of these sources tell you that Hamas broke the truce that existed between that leadership in Gaza and Israel, and therefore the Israelis had no choice but to attack in the kind of bloodthirsty way that they have, with the result of, what are we, approaching 900 people dead now. And because Gaza happens to be one of the most densely populated urban areas on earth, of these roughly 900 dead, probably 700 or 800 of them are civilians. And of those 700 or 800, probably 300 are children. And this is being spun by the Israeli government as an heroic act of self-defense. Well, let's listen to what you'll hear the BBC reporter first, and then about 40 or 50 seconds in, you'll hear Mark Regev, who is a spokesman for the Israeli Prime Minister, admitting as to who really broke the ceasefire truce. All right, here it is.
There was a time when Israelis were safe from Hamas rockets during the recent ceasefire. In May, there were 149 rocket attacks. In June, before the ceasefire started on the 18th, there were 84. In the rest of June, just 3. Throughout July, August, September and October, there were only 15 attacks, and Israel agrees that none of these rockets were fired by Hamas. On November the 4th, Israel launched an attack that killed 6 Hamas fighters just inside the Gaza Strip. They say the militants were building a tunnel to try and kidnap an Israeli soldier. The result was a fresh barrage of rockets from Hamas. After November the 4th, there were 68 and 52 in December. During the entire period of the ceasefire, no Israelis were killed by Hamas rockets.
Our goals are minimalistic and defensive. Success is freeing the civilian population of southern Israel from the fear of an incoming Hamas rocket.
But if that was the case, there were no Hamas rockets during the ceasefire. Before November the 4th, there were no Hamas rockets for 4 months.
And that's correct.
There were no Hamas rockets for 4 months. And the Israeli government spokesman says that's correct. And again, I'll ask the same thing that I asked earlier tonight. Given that little bit of truth, unless we assume that the BBC reporter and the Israeli government spokesman are both anti-Semitic, Israel-hating bastards. And I don't see how we can assume that. AIPAC would have you believe that any reporter who tells the truth is thus and such. But Mark Regev is a spokesman for the Israeli prime minister, therefore the Israeli government. And Mr. Regev just said, you heard it, that it was not Hamas that broke the truce. So my question, excuse me, earlier to this evening, and the question remains, why have you not heard that comment on American television? Why has not been reported on the front page of the New York Times or the Washington Post, the two newspapers of record in this sad, lied-to country of ours? Why do you suppose the listeners to the BBC get to hear a spokesman for the Israeli prime minister categorically state that it was not Hamas that broke the truce? And yet, we, here in the United States, what are we, goddamn prisoners? We do not get to hear that truth, do we? And my only question to you, other than the impotent rage that I feel, my question for you is to consider, why do we not hear what listeners to the BBC hear? Anybody, can I see a show? Anybody got any ideas? Any show of hands? Anybody want to take a stab at that one? Well, it was Hamas! It was Hamas that broke the truce! Well, somebody ought to clue in Mark Regev, the spokesman for the Israeli prime minister, that it was Hamas that broke the truce. Your phone calls when we come back. The number is 800-989-1480.
Capable of being wise about the money.
Capable of being wise about the money. Yeah, okay. We will pick up the discussion on a couple other topics, including the ongoing crisis in Gaza tomorrow. We just I thought it was extremely necessary to put on the air some of the comments from George W. Bush today at his so-called last press interview. I say so-called because you never know what's going to happen in the next how many days until the swearing-in of Barack Obama? What is today, Kathy? The 12th? It's the 11th? It's a week. There's no telling what could happen in a week. But as far as I know, other than some of the accumulated the verbal garbage that this rat bastard has spewed onto the American public over the past 8 years that we use as a what do you call those? Not liners, but drops. Other than those, we will try to eliminate the physical presence of this this failed little miserable man. We're going to be dealing with the failure of his policies and the Republican Party's policies for a long, long time to come. But as far as George W. Bush and his idiocies, I'm so over it. Oh my God, I'm over it. Let's do some phone call. Excuse me, some phone calls as promised. Let's see. How about Dale, who is calling from St. Paul, Minnesota, listening on KTNF, right?
Right.
Welcome to the program, Dale.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Mike, I got to be honest with you. Today's Bush's last speech today was the only one I could listen to from the beginning to end. Every one he did before, every interview, I just couldn't make it. But today I watch it from the beginning to end.
And why? Because you knew it was his last one?
No, it wasn't because of that. It's like, you know, it's kind of like watching Kathy Lee Gifford, you know? You know, you just wonder what the heck the broad is going to say next, you know?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean.
it's just amazing. And after he talks about all his failures, one right after another, he says, you know, this is fun. You know, this is really fun, you know?
Yeah.
He actually used the word fun. And I mean, he's as cavalier as some boozer who just took his obligatory turn as treasurer at the Moose Club or something.
You're really, exactly.
It was unbelievable.
Well, I've had actually about 9.5 years of this guy, because when the Republicans announced back in 99 that he was going to be their nominee. Uh-huh. That the decision almost had been made prior to the first primary, and we started doing checking on his record in Texas.
Uh-huh.
And it became clear, and his personal failings as a human being, as an American, as a businessman, as somebody who was supposed to serve his military obligation. Every single thing Bush had ever touched had been an abject, miserable failure. And in so many instances, if not all instances, someone had to bail him out. His daddy, the Saudis, investors, somebody had to bail this worthless son of a bitch out. And knowing that, before a vote was ever cast for him, you know, I just thought, well, as long as I have a radio program on WLS in Chicago that reaches half the country, I'll do my best to spread this information. And as a result of that, my efforts anyway, I lost my job at WLS because they were complete right-wing Nazis. So even my little program late in the evening, it was reaching too many people across the Midwest at night, and well, the eastern half of the country, so it had to go. So I've been living with this miserable sack of blood and guts for the past 9.5 years, and I am so glad to see him gone. So I hear what you're saying. Dale, thanks, man. Thanks for checking in. I appreciate the call, all right?
Yep.
All right, sir. Take care.
Yep.
How about Bob is calling from Seattle, listening on the Internet. Hey, Bob.
Yeah, hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi. Of course, this is not Bob from superbeans.com, right?
No, this is not Bob. It's Bob from Seattle, but not the same Bob.
I hear you. All right, Bob.
Yeah, I wanted to say you don't count the dead when God's on your side. To answer your question about what motivates this neocon philosophy that this dark philosophy we've all been oppressed with here for the last 8 years. You know, Mike, before a judge sentences somebody, mm-hmm. they look at whether or not the defendant has any remorse.
Right, right.
And they take that into consideration before they determine, you know, the severity of the sentence.
True.
So when we look at the thing that really frightens me about these sociopaths, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, I mean, just the whole gang of these people, these reptilian vampires, is the fact that, my God, they have no human characteristics. They have no remorse. They have no redemptive qualities. This is what's frightening.
That's true. To think that a group like this got control of the United States.
Yes, and they've got control. And I heard Bob Shrum today on talking to David Schuster, and they were discussing Hillary Clinton being our Secretary of State nominee and the fact that Bill Clinton got all of these contributions to his library that have now been made public, and whether or not that was going to be a conflict. Bob Shrum, in defense of Hillary, said, does anyone think in this country that somebody could be elected president or be Secretary of State that was not 100% pro-Israel? He said, if they thought that, what planet are they from?
Mm-hmm.
This is Bob. These are the criminal elements, this gangster mentality, Mike, that you, unfortunately, we all have lived under, that we know so well. No longer are we a nation that desires peace. We've become a reptilian, vampire nation where our politicians are nothing but prostitutes. Our military has become a mercenary force that's for hire from foreign entities. In fact, Condoleezza Rice actually had drafted peace accords between Gaza and Israel, and she was ready to sign off on that and vote on that at the UN. And Olmert called Bush and told him that he didn't want Condoleezza Rice to vote that way in the UN, so she said she was embarrassed because she couldn't vote that way.
Yeah, I've heard a couple variations of that particular story, and
yeah.
I'm going to track it down. But it's my understanding that one of the final acts by this hapless shoe lady, Secretary of State of ours, was to have a resolution that she introduced. She was, or had a hand in introducing. She was forced to abstain from voting. So a final indignity for a lousy Secretary of State in a lousy administration was that.
It makes you proud to be an American, Mike.
It makes me something. Bob, listen, thank you. I appreciate
you
checking in. All right, sir. Take care. Take care. Yeah, I have that story somewhere on the stack, and tomorrow night we're going to talk a little bit more about that. And also, not just what is happening in Gaza, but also what is going to happen when the Obama administration takes the power given to it by the American people, unlike George W. Bush. When Obama is elected, sworn in as president, what will happen where it concerns 8 years of ongoing criminal activity by the Bush crime family? What will happen as far as investigations or hearings? And I think it's very clear now that the Democratic Party, all the way up to Barack Obama, has no intention whatsoever of pursuing these criminal acts. And I believe this, to the extent that Barack Obama impedes or denies such investigations, he is complicit in the acts committed by George Bush, these crimes against humanity, these war crimes. We are still a country that calls itself a representative democracy, a democratic republic, And if we call ourselves that and we have these peaceful transitions of power and a subsequent leader refuses to acknowledge or have investigated the crimes of a previous leader, the subsequent leader becomes complicit. Ten before the hour, thanks to our engineer, Ian Huff. Ben Birch is our podcast manager and technical advisor. Our military affairs correspondent, Sharon Gordy. Bruce Enberg is our economic advisor, and the program's ethical advisors are Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolf. Catherine Bay is the executive producer. Sheila writes in the story that Bob was just talking about. Dateline is Jerusalem. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was left shamefaced after President George W. Bush ordered her to abstain in a key U.N. vote on the Gaza war, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said on Monday. Olmert said in a speech in the southern town of Ashkelon, quote, she was left shamed, a resolution that she prepared and arranged, and in the end, she did not vote in favor, end quote. The UN Security Council passed a resolution last Thursday calling for an immediate ceasefire in the three-week-old conflict in the Gaza Strip and an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza where hundreds have been killed. 14 of the council's 15 members voted in favor of the resolution, which was later rejected by both Israel and Hamas. The United States, Israel's main ally, had initially been expected to vote in line with the other 14, but Rice later became the sole abstention. Olmert said, quote, in the night between Thursday and Friday, when the Secretary of State wanted to lead the vote on a ceasefire at the Security Council, we did not want her to vote in favor. I said, get me President Bush on the phone. They said he was in the middle of giving a speech in Philadelphia. I said, I didn't care. I need to talk to him now. He got off the podium and spoke to me. I told him the United States could not vote in favor. It cannot vote in favor of such a resolution. He immediately called the Secretary of State and told her not to vote in favor. End quote. Bush has consistently placed the blame for the conflict on Hamas, telling reporters on Monday that while he wanted to see a, quote, sustainable ceasefire, end quote, in Gaza, it was up to Hamas to choose to end its rocket fire on Israel. So there you have it. For very simply, if that's not a clear indication that the head of the government in Israel can dictate American foreign policy, well, then one of you brilliant listeners to this program, tell me what that is, if it's not that. He's giving a speech, Mr. Prime Minister. I don't care! Tell him to call me now. So that's the story about what happened with Condoleezza Rice. And that's being reported by Agence France-Presse, the French news agency. I didn't hear that on tonight's ABC, CBS, or NBC news either. Anybody else hear that one? That story or the story of the spokesman for Mr. Olmert saying that, no, Hamas did not violate the truce or the ceasefire. The truce, I guess it was. Did not indeed. And the BBC reporting that the truce actually was broken by the Israeli government. Not a word of that. other than foreign news sources are on this program, has anyone heard of that today? I certainly hadn't until Bob Alexander sent me the clip, the BBC clip. I hadn't heard anything. Have you? Did you know that, Truth Seeker? Did you know that a spokesman for the Israeli government, Mark Regev, admitted that Israel broke the ceasefire truce, not Hamas? Or did he? Was that just a misstatement? He misspoke, or maybe Mr. Mark Regev really hates the Jews, or wants to see Israel ended, or something. Because the story is that Hamas broke the ceasefire. How could a spokesman for the Israeli prime minister say otherwise? As a matter of fact, 180 degrees otherwise. How could that be? There must be a problem here. And for the people who laugh and say, oh, get serious, when the statement's made on this program by me or guests or callers, that the Israeli government influences U.S. foreign policy, then what about this? What about this statement that is reported? I don't know, maybe the French news agency are liars. Maybe they are just anti-Semitic and want to see Israel pushed into the sea. Could that be? Sure, I guess it could. But the French news agency is reporting quotes from Ehud Olmert. When I heard what Condoleezza Rice was going to vote in favor of, I called her boss and said no. And I was told that her boss was busy giving a speech, and I said, get him on the phone. And then I told him to tell his Secretary of State not to vote in favor of the resolution. And she did not. So what does that mean? Does that mean that I don't know. I don't know anymore. Do you? We'll pick up the discussion again tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.